Welcome. You're listening to the Mac Observer's Background Mode. This is your host, John Martellaro. And this week, my guest is Tech.Pinions, technical journalist, John Kirk. John, welcome to the show.
And thank you for having me.
I've been an admirer of you for a long time. When you burst on the scene a few years ago, I noticed that you had a particularly astute and eloquent way of talking about Apple, one of the best Apple writers I know when it comes to literary approach, and your articles are always full of applicable and awesome quotes, and you are just so in tune with Apple psychology that I've been a big fan of yours for years.
Well, you're much too kind, although I appreciate your statement about being in touch with Apple psychology, because that's a lot of what I write about.
It is. But before we get into that, I wanted to ask you, you told me the other day that you were an attorney in your career.
Yes.
How did you decide to become an attorney?
Well, it's a little embarrassing. Basically, when I was growing up, I talked a lot. And people have a tendency to think that people who talk a lot should make for good attorneys. Turns out that's not really true. Talking doesn't have all that much to do with being an attorney. But we get into our jobs and our fields sometimes for the strangest reasons. And that's all right. I moved into that, and being an attorney gave me a chance to use a lot of the things that I enjoy, including being analytical.
Was law school like we see it on TV, or was it very different? I mean, well, by that I mean there's a lot of tenseness and melodrama and shows about lawyers. And having been a physicist myself, I know that, you know, it's pretty calm and relaxed, but there's a lot of tension and a lot of hard work. How was your experience in law school?
Well, you know, classroom work is boring and not all that exciting. But I will tell you, on my first day of class, they said, look to your left and look to your right. One of you is not going to be here
at the end. I had a professor do that too.
that was a great start. Very, very scary. And that worked. And the other thing I noticed is that I guess it's just like with football, you can be a star at the high school level and you can be a star, then not make it to college, or you can be a star at the college level and not make it in the pros. Right. As you go up, when you get in law school, you find out that everybody is as smart as you or smarter. And that's sometimes a shock, you know. So it's a very, very competitive environment.
I was talking to a physicist friend when I was in graduate school. We were on the phone the other night, and he's been a physics professor for years up in the Northwest. And we were reminiscing about life and times in graduate school together, and about a professor who got annoyed with the class one day and said, you know, I really don't know why I'm wasting my time with you guys. So, yeah, well, you run across a lot of different kind of mentalities and personalities in graduate school and in law school.
I think I mentioned this to you. We spoke a couple of days ago in preparation for this. There's a saying with lawyers that people who graduate from law school with A's become judges. People who graduate with A's become professors. People who graduate with B's become judges. And people who graduate with C's become rich. So with lawyers, it's not always the quality of your learning that determines your success in life. But it does make, when the professors tell you they're wasting their time on you, I think they probably think that's true.
Yeah. So you became a trial attorney.
Yes.
That's awesome. I've had some other attorneys on the show, but they were involved in patent law or corporate law, but you were in the thick of it. I guess the ability to chat and talk and frame a logical argument paid off.
Yeah, or the other way around, that all those things taught me to do those things. When you're doing trial work, I will say that there's a few things as exciting as trial work. I think being shot at in a war would be more exciting. But when you're doing trial work, you're literally standing live in front of a judge and 12 jurors. Mm-hmm. And mistakes you make, you can't say, wait a minute, let me undo that. And you have to, there's somebody on the other side that's coming at you hard trying to prove that you're basically completely wrong. So it's a pretty exciting, if it's a game, it's a very exciting game.
And there's somebody who's depending on you very much, too, and putting their trust in you. That's got to be awesome.
Well, it can be awesome, and it can be, you know, humbling, right? Because sometimes when you do trial work and you're working with a plaintiff, you recognize this is their one and only shot to in their case. And if you mess up or if you lose, that's the last chance they'll get. So it's a lot of pressure.
So how did you fall into the Apple sphere? I know attorneys, from my experience, are not particularly known for being heavy users of Apple products, especially MacBooks. They tend to be kind of Windows oriented. Was there a time in your life that you decided to use Macs in your work, or did you do it on the side? How did that happen?
Well, I was interested in computers going all the way back pretty much to the beginning. I was looking into them even in the 70s. My brother got an Apple II. And when I became an attorney, the Macintosh came out in 1984. Mm-hmm. And I was absolutely blown away. And I could not afford to buy the original Macintosh. It was 128 kilobytes of memory.
Yep.
And it cost like $2,400 in 1984 dollars. And so I waited until the Fat Mac, they called it. It was 512K. Woo.
Kilobytes, folks.
Yeah.
Kilobytes.
Hard to believe. Yeah. And when it came out, I bought the original Mac. In other words, I bought it 1 year late. So in 1985, I bought my first Mac, and I dragged it into my law office. And from that moment on, I became basically the unofficial IT guy for every law firm that I was ever in. Everywhere I went, I became the guy who brought in the computers, because back then law firms didn't have computers.
But then there came a time when they became kind of Windows oriented. Would that create a problem in terms of accessing certain information or using certain products or apps?
They totally did. They flipped over in the 90s when Apple was having a tough time. And at first, the Macintosh did okay. But then there were certain programs, word processing programs, for example, that were considered to be used by attorneys, and they only ran on PCs. All the firms flipped over. I suspect a lot of people might have retroactively been annoyed with me for bringing Macintoshes in instead of Microsoft PCs.
Could that have been Word Perfect?
Yeah, that was a huge program for attorneys back then.
I remember going through that. That was a tough thing for Apple to do battle with.
Yeah. Yeah, because there were a lot of exclusive programs back then. And you might remember, you could go into a computer store and they would have like two Apple products like sitting in the corner, and they'd be covered in dust. And if you walked over and said you wanted to look at them, the salesman would just take you and steer you somewhere else. He had no intention of selling them, which is why Apple eventually had to open their own retail stores.
Those were the dark years. I remember going into a office supply store where they had one Mac in the back of the store, and the CD tray was broken.
Yeah.
And it was in disarray, and it wasn't really a great experience. It was awful. So I lived through that too. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a miracle that Apple's still in existence.
Did you start reading about Apple online, or, the magazines, to sort of get into the culture?
Oh, I used to read every page of every app. There were two major Mac magazines back then. Mm-hmm. I would read every page, including the advertisements, because all the information was new and interesting. And what I found over time was that I knew pretty much everything there was in those magazines. And over time, they would add a new layer of this and a new layer of that. And they grew away from me. I just could not keep up. In other words, it used to be you could be you could know everything about computing back in the early days, because there wasn't that much to know. And then as time went on, they became so complex that you can only learn, certain, portions of them, certain specialities.
Yeah, that's true. Come to think of it, lived through those days myself, and the amount of information that you have to cope with these days, not even mentioning keeping track of the security issues and things to be aware of. I do it, for a living, and I can't imagine how people who have to work at a day job can possibly keep track of all of this information and security risks and tips and how to do things and how to manage their Mac and how to do proper backups. It just can be overwhelming. Well, that's what we do. That's our job, is to help people out.
Yeah.
Yeah.
I do agree with you that a lot of times I'll run into a problem and I'll be banging my head against it. And I keep saying to myself, well, I've been into computers since the 70s. I've had a Macintosh since the 80s. I graduated from law school. I got a securities, you know, Series 7. I'm not a dumb guy and I like this stuff. And if I can't do it, then how is the average person figuring it out?
I know.
And it is amazing. There's just a lot of stuff that is not intuitive, to put it mildly.
So then there came a time a few years ago, I don't remember what year, but you burst on the scene writing at Tech.Pinions with Ben Baharin.
I think it's Baharin.
Yeah. And right away I thought, wow, who is this guy? How did he learn to write this well? Where does he get these quotes? How does he have such a powerful and strong and informed and eloquent perspective about Apple? Who is this guy? Started sending your emails.
Well, I appreciate all that. That's very nice of you.
How did you land that job?
Well, it turned out I just started to, you know, it was easier and easier to get onto online discussions as time went on. And around 2006, 2005, I started to, pardon me, I started to comment on various, you know, blogs and things. And one of the ones I stumbled across was Tech.Pinions. And I would leave comments there about things that I thought. And some of my comments, as is typical of my articles, were way too long. And instead of being punished for that, Ben Baharin one day, who, by the way, the Baharins are two of the nicest people you will ever meet. Just total stand-up guys, in case you don't know them or do know them. Wonderful people to work with. But Ben reached out to me and he said, how would you like, you know, these are some interesting comments. How would you like to write an article? And I was like, sure. And I wrote a couple articles and I never looked back. That is not the recommended way to become somebody who writes articles. But I snuck in through a side door.
Well, you know, it's not a bad way after all. There is a fellow who does the same thing with me, Dr. Brooks, who writes practically mini novels in response to some of my articles. And I've been trying to get him on the show. But he's a physician and works a lot overseas, so it's tough to get him on the show. But, you know, when somebody sends you a resume out of the blue, you can get overwhelmed by people who are trying to just, you know, contact you and weasel their way in. But commenting in the comment section and showing what you can do and become a participant is very helpful. I remember one time a woman wrote me and she said, my son wants to work for Apple. How can I do that? And I said, well, he needs to become an expert on something, become an acknowledged expert, whatever it is, and then start interacting with the community and then become noted as a leader. And then when you apply for a job at Apple, they go, oh, yeah, we know him. He's the one who's the expert on OpenCL and has been finding bugs in all our software. Yeah, let's hire him.
Yeah.
So that's one way to do it.
You do see Apple plucking people from the writing field, people who write about technology issues, and then suddenly they're working for Apple.
I think Chris Breen is one of those.
Yeah.
Yeah. So one of the things I'm impressed with is how you manage to collect and organize all that information. You told me that you use Scrivener as a writing tool.
Right.
Does Scrivener, is that your tool for also managing keeping track of all the quotes?
Yes, I use Scrivener for both my writing and for collecting all the quotes so that I can have them all in one place. I'm not sure they have the ability to, like, it's really a book writing program, and the idea is you could separate your files into different books, but I just keep everything in one gigantic file so that I can search through and find the various quotes and things that I'm interested in.
Do you keep track of web links there as well?
I used to do that a lot more. I used to basically keep, what you do is just, I just copied and pasted the links into the quotes that I had, and then I could link back to them. And that made it.
Do you use some sort of keyword system where you can go find a quote?
Yeah, they have a fantastic search.
Talked about money or something, whatever.
Yeah. It doesn't always work because sometimes the quotes are not exactly what you think they are. But that's exactly what I do is I guess I have enough knowledge on the quotes that I usually can remember the gist of them, and I can type in a few words and find the quote that I'm looking for.
Ah, okay. Well, It's time to take a break. When we come back, I want to talk to you about how you've become so learned and eloquent. I'm writing about Apple, and we'll talk about some people who don't, or not by name anyway. But anyway, folks, we need to take a short break. We'll be back in 60 seconds. I'm chatting with John Kirk. Stay with us.
Hello there, all you fabulous Background Mode listeners. I'm Kelly Gamont with the Mac Observer, and I just want to say a few words about how you can support all the things we do. If you're thinking about buying something from Apple, Amazon, or Mac Mall, just go to the Mac Observer's homepage where we have a section called Support TMO. Or you can just enter macobserver.com/Apple Store, all one word, and that will take you to our special page for Apple and our other affiliates. If you make a purchase from one of our partners this way, the Mac Observer receives a small compensation for sending business their direction. Pretty cool, right? And you don't pay a penny more. This small fee from our affiliates helps us continue to bring you TMO's daily news, reviews, tips, how-tos, and podcasts like this one. So the next time you're thinking about an online purchase, come to TMO's homepage and support the Mac Observer. Thanks. Back to you, John.
Thank you, Kelly. I'm chatting with Tech.Pinion's technical journalist, John Kirk. John, so one of the things you told me you wanted to talk about, and I'm curious to hear your thoughts, is there are people, writers, who seem to make a living being negative about Apple, and they do it in lots of different ways, either by getting the facts wrong or by presuming to know something that maybe they don't really know. What do you think's driving the business of people who make a living being so negative about Apple?
Well, there's a lot of people doing it, that's for sure. There are certainly some people who are frankly just foolish, and you can dismiss them. There's people who have just bad opinions. There are people who are pretty clearly doing it for clickbait. They're just writing something contrary to get people to click on their site. Then there's a certain section of people who are into the Apple is doomed field, and of course, all these overlap, right? You know, I mean, it's not like you're just one or the other. And then there's, for me, that gives me a chance to have the whole Apple claim chowder deal where you get to basically go back. Well, one of the beautiful things about computing is you can reel back and pull up all those terrible opinions that people wrote. I just happen to have one here. This is written in 2013. It says, Apple has nothing new in the pipeline. Right. And that was written by Henry Blodgett, who continues to write and is very well respected. So it doesn't really matter if you get it wrong, it seems, in this field. You can just keep on getting it wrong and people will consistently, keep reading what you say. And I sort of have a philosophy of that an unrefuted falsehood, if said, often enough, becomes an irrefutable truth. So I think it's very important to counter these people and occasionally push back and point out.
Or it becomes truthiness.
Yes, right. When I was young, there was Aesop's fable of a crying wolf. And the lesson we were supposed to learn there is that if you lie about something like there being a wolf, that later on in life, people won't believe you when you tell the truth. But it seems to me that you can look around today and see that the real lesson there is that Aesop may have gotten it wrong. The real lesson is you keep crying wolf long enough, people will believe there's a wolf. And people believe that Apple is a sheep and that their competitors are wolves. And they keep saying that Apple is doomed and people keep believing them.
One of the things that you do particularly well, and I try to do, is puncture those false memes with experience and real information and facts. I think a lot of writers have sort of like their own bubble or universe of belief about Apple. And because Apple is so closed, it's hard to penetrate that veil. And so Apple does something and you take it at face value without perspective. And then you draw the wrong conclusions about what they're doing. And I've discovered that almost everything Apple does has some hidden thing going on that you don't know about. Having worked for Apple helps with that. So
yes,
you see it from the inside and then you see it from the outside and you can compare and see how it goes.
Yeah, I'm not great. I'm not sure this is a great analogy, but Apple's like an iceberg. You only see like 1/7 of them. The rest of them is hidden. And in some ways, that makes them very exciting to write about because you're constantly trying to guess the parts that you can't see and to weave them into a pattern that makes sense. Because they know so much more about what they're doing and where they're going than we. And it makes it very exciting.
And I know personally that Apple's very happy to let you go wrong. And you just laugh, sit around the room and go, hey, did you see this nonsense from Martellaro the other day? He's such a crackpot.
let me throw out one more quick thing on, on Chris. I'll try to do this as quickly as I can. Recently, Richard Thaler is an economist, and he won the Nobel Prize in Economics. And his entire career was based on proving that economics, people don't think like economists, and that people are human beings, and that there are human nature things that we should take into account. And I often think, for example, an economist thinks that if you have three choices, that's good, but if you have 30 choices, that's better. But a human being knows that that's not true. 30 choices just paralyzes you. You're just overwhelmed. So you can hear the same thing being echoed in the computing industry, right? Engineers think more choices are always good. And human beings go, nah, maybe not. You know, sometimes just give me a couple choices, or sometimes even just one. And that just drives the engineer types crazy, because they can't understand why people wouldn't do what's what they consider to be best for them. And I think that's a big part of the tension that you see with Apple. Apple is into design, and design is the answer between technology and human beings. It's the interface. And engineers can create tremendously beautiful engineered products that are terribly designed. And they often don't understand that there's a difference between those two.
The problem is that sometimes the simplicity that you promote in order to become more human in your approach to the customer can often produce misperceptions and misunderstandings of the technology that drive people batty. One good example of this is the recent battery gate situation, where Apple tried to avoid overwhelming people with the technical specifications of lithium-ion batteries and how they work. And people tend to think of batteries as going from 100 down to zero, but when a battery, a lithium-ion battery, is only able to keep 70 or 80% of its charge, it's not able to produce the voltage, as I understand it, and it dies, and it takes your phone down. So
human beings can't comprehend that. Yeah. I mean, I tried listening to podcasts on that, and it bent my mind. And there are people who aren't interested at all, so there's no way they're going to understand that. They think of it as a gas tank. It's either got gas in it or not, and that's not how batteries. But Apple knows that you hide that stuff, and then every once in a while they get caught, like they did with this battery situation. So they're going to add another thing in the setting, and what's going to happen is no one's going to use it. A few people at the top end will use it, people who understand what they're doing, and then they'll find out it's maybe not as good as they thought it was and it'll all be forgotten again.
Yep, I agree. Just like you're holding it wrong.
Yes.
Steve Jobs.
What, you remember Bendgate? That was like the most ridiculous thing. People took the phone in their hands and literally tried to break it. And I'm thinking, yeah, that will break it. You know? So I don't know why that's a problem. Don't do that. But that's the you're holding it wrong thing, right? You're breaking it wrong.
Right. So you and I are old timers, and we grew up with Macs.
Yeah.
Yeah. And so there was kind of a painful few years there from 2015 and 16. Apple seemed to lose its way on the Macintosh. And I use a 2013 Mac Pro, and I thought, you know, what's happening? Is this the end of the line for the Macs? I love my Mac Pro, by the way. It's a perfect writer's Macintosh, but that's an aside. So now Apple seems to be back on track again. Do you think Apple's found its way, made a little slip up, now they're firmly back on track, and they realize what they did, and they love the Mac, and we can expect all sorts of new good things? What do you think?
Well, I think I can summarize that in three thoughts. One is, most of the stuff about the Mac is the part of the iceberg that's still beneath the water. They have got a lot of their future thoughts on that hidden away from us, and we don't know where they're going or what they're thinking, so it's difficult to project. The other thing, though, is Tim Cook has said several times that the Mac is an important part of what Apple is doing. And I tend to believe him. I don't think Apple could have basically just dropped the Mac line or made it all iOS operating system based. And then we wouldn't be having this conversation. But I think they're committed to the Macs. And I think they made some missteps. But I think Apple is going to, well, you and I were having a conversation about operating systems and where they're going. I think Apple is going into more operating systems, not less. They have a separate operating system for the watch, for the phone. They look like they might be coming out with almost splitting off the tablet. Even right now, the phone and the tablet are the same. They're really becoming two different ways of using a device. So they're coming up with a different operating system for each one of their form factors. So I don't think the Mac is going away. I think Apple is definitely committed to it. And they think it's an important, it's not the central part of their lives anymore, but it's peripheral that they think is crucial to keeping their customers happy and keeping their line moving forward.
What do you think about the root security snafu and some of the other minor problems that they've been having lately with access security? There was another one the other day where you could get into the Mac App Store without any password at all.
Well, I try not to think about it. Well, it's way over my head, way over my pay scale. I watch it from afar and read these things. I mean, there is some criticism that Apple's been getting sloppy lately. Yeah. And, I'm not sure that you can go back through any time in Apple's history when Steve Jobs was there or when he wasn't there, that Apple didn't make the same kind of mistakes. But of course, we want to see as few of these mistakes as possible.
The difference is those people got fired by Steve personally. You read about it.
And screamed at them in the elevator on their way out. So that was Steve Jobs. Tim Cook is a little more, behind the scenes in those kind of things.
Do you have any thoughts on the Mac Pro that Apple says is coming? The modular, upgradable Mac Pro. I'm scared to think about how much it's going to cost.
I really don't. It's as I said, for me, there's just, one of the things I found in writing that you can do that you can't do on a podcast is that when you don't know something, you just don't write about it. but you're calling me out here and asking a question. But so often I start to think about an area and I start to write about it and I realize I don't know the answer to this. So I just back off and don't write about it. I really don't know the answer to that question. It's really a mystery to me.
I wrote an article the other day about Apple's life and times with the MacBook Air and what a fabulous notebook computer that was. And it really made us feel special. Talked about being on an airplane and sitting next to some guy with a black plastic ThinkBook, with the little red button in the middle of the keyboard and sitting there with his Excel spreadsheet. And you pull out this sleek aluminum MacBook Air and start doing stuff on it. And, you just felt like you were a extraterrestrial, came down to visit with your sleek MacBook Air weighing 3 pounds. And it was quite a feeling. The iMac Pro is sort of verging on that too. I mean, that's a machine that's got people wound up for the first time in a long time, I think, because Apple seemed to be paying too much attention to style and not horsepower. And Microsoft and Hewlett Packard were sensing that and sort of like creeping in with the technical professionals. So my thought is that the Mac Pro is going to be absolutely awesome. One of the things I was thinking about, maybe just a fantasy, was that instead of having an Intel processor, it would have 128 A12s in parallel processing supercomputer, and then it would emulate the Intel chipset and have a speed of 500 teraflops or something like that as a parallel processing Mac. But you can imagine Apple trying to pull something like that off, but I think it's just going to be maybe a super iMac Pro without a display. Still going to be pretty expensive, though. So, it'll give Apple a chance to really punctuate its commitment.
Apple, as you know, is very much into design. Well, let me preface this. One of the things that makes Apple unique, and there's so many things that make them unique, but one of the things is that they're very conservative when moving forward and very aggressive when cutting off from the back end. So what they do is they won't move into new technology until they feel that it's ready. And they move away from old technology as soon as they think it's possible. Mm-hmm. And that leaves in a very narrow band, and they get criticized for that. But it works for the customers, for their target audience. It's exactly what they want. They want things to work, and they don't want to have to worry about legacy stuff, and they don't want to have to worry about technology that's cutting edge or bleeding edge, that hurts them instead of helps them. But Apple's very much into design, and there's a lot of rules for design. I will probably mispronounce this gentleman's name. Dieter Rams is one of the people they take inspiration from. And one of his rules was good design is long lasting. And if you look back on Apple's products, you begin to see that, like, people think of technology as gadgets, right? And they quickly turn over. But Apple's products don't really turn over. You look back at the Macintosh, and yeah, it looks a lot different. But some of the things that they introduced in 2001 are still around today. If MP3 players were around, I guarantee you everybody would be using a click wheel because they found out the right interface.
Yeah.
You look at notebook computers, they all look like Macintoshes. Everybody basically used to have, like you said, the little button in the middle. There were all these different interface designs. And Apple eventually comes up with a design that works, and then everybody adopts it. The iPhone, right? You can look at phones 2006. Just Google 2006 phones.
Or we saw those famous pictures in the lawsuits where it showed Samsung phones before the iPhone and Samsung's after the iPhone. Remember those?
Right. And they're all everything now looks the same. And people think it's boring. But what it means is when everything looks the same, it means that that the design is right. Or I should say, if everything looks the same and continues, you know, be long lasting. And Apple gets a design, you can tell if they got it right by whether it stays pretty much the same. So Apple's struggling with the high end right now, but I think this is one of the things they're looking for. When they try to come up with a solution, they're trying to come up with a solution that will be the solution, the design solution that will last for a long, long time.
Well, what do you think they can do with the design of the new Mac Pro? Because they seem to have learned their lesson, got overly cutesy with the 2013 black trash can. The high-end Hewlett-Packard workstations are basically, you know, the boxy towers. And they're beloved for what they can do, not how they look.
Well, there's always a tension in design between creating something that you want it to work, but you also want it to work eloquently, you know, to be elegant and to be, you know, move in a way that moves the same way you do. And sometimes Apple, especially with Johnny Ive, he can occasionally seems like he gets more into the design and less into having he gets into form over function. And there's a lot of people who criticize him for that. And Apple needs to, people say, well, they need to get more function. True. But what you need to do is do form and function simultaneously. And that's why it's hard. That's where it's going to be difficult for them.
Yep, I agree. Well, we're about out of time. It's gone fast. I have one more question I want to ask you that we were talking about earlier. You are an eloquent spokesman for what makes Apple so special, how they're fundamentally different from other companies. And one of those elements that occurred to me is the legacy and almost the ghost of Steve Jobs. I was watching his MacBook Air introduction from 2008. And if you ever wanted to see a demo about how to introduce a product and how to wind up your audience and how to address weaknesses as positives and how to be a showman, that 2008 Macworld introduction of the MacBook Air is just sort of the quintessential demonstration of how Steve Jobs introduced new products and made you love it. And you know, Tim Cook speaks articulately about that influence on Apple and how that drives everything they do. Do you think Apple can sustain that legacy? Because as time goes on, it's going to be harder.
Well, let me give you the downside and the upside. When Steve Jobs died, about 2 weeks after his death, they had a memorial service on campus. And Johnny Ive spoke. And Johnny Ive is well known for being incredibly shy. And he gave a beautiful eulogy. And there was one part in there that really stuck out to me. And let me see if I can throw this at you. He said, Steve used to say to me, and he used to say this a lot, "Hey, Johnny, here's a dopey idea." And sometimes they were really dopey. Sometimes they were truly dreadful. But sometimes they took the air from the room and they left us both completely silent. Bold, crazy, magnificent ideas, or simply quiet ones, which in their subtlety, their detail, and their utterly profound. I think that cannot, I mean, Johnny Ive is the person who does the design there, but you cannot buy that for any price. That is just something that's going to be missing from Apple. You just don't, you will never know what Steve Jobs could have come up with had he stayed alive. But on the other side of this, I'll say that on the pro side is that Apple may have been Steve Jobs' greatest, finest, and most long-lasting product. He worked very hard on Apple in the last years of his life. He basically wanted Apple, the company, to be something unique and something that would continue. And we won't know that until we look back. But you kind of have to give him the benefit of the doubt. He really had done a fabulous job with that company. He's made it something that's very unique. And he did it precisely so that they could continue to be Apple in the future. He once asked, how can I make a $10 billion company without losing its soul? Now you're asking, how can you make almost a $1 trillion company without losing its soul? And he hopes he has an answer to that. And I hope he does too.
Excellent. Excellent. I hope so too. Well, we really are out of time right now. I want to thank you, excuse me, for being on the show. It's been a delightful discussion. Thank you so much.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. I appreciate it.
Tell the listeners how they can contact you if they wish.
Well, probably the best way is on Twitter. It's pretty easy. I'm just at John Kirk, JohnKirk.
All right, cool. Well, folks, thank you for joining us. I hope you enjoyed the discussion. We will be back next week on the Mac Observer's Background Mode.